propped up with oil wealth from the state to fund your operations. You joined up with the goons in the Solnetsevskaya Bratva to give you foot soldiers for your ops. Vladdy used Terry Cassidy as his money launderer, and you used Terry Cassidy as some sort of a middleman to help you acquire non-Russian goons, to help you recover a man detained by the CIA.
Zakharov's face reddened. This is all the theory of your friends in the CIA?
I'm here on my own, Papa. I told you. I heard about the attack at Turnhill. I know Cassidy was the man who helped set it up. I know Belyakov works with him. That indicates to me that you were involved in the attack and involved with the leak out of the CIA.
And you have come to plug the CIA's leak. Is that it?
I came to find out about you, about Fyodor, about Mother. That is all.
Zakharov stood, looming over her. A door opened suddenly and four men entered. Among them was the man who called himself Fox that she'd run into in London the previous night. They'd obviously been just outside and listening in on the conversation. Fox said,
Sir, it's time.
The older Russian smiled at his daughter.
I'm going to need to keep you close to me, Zoya, just for the next few days. After that, you are free to choose. You can stay with me here, or you can return to Russia.
He sighed.
You won't be returning to America. Not as long as I have blood pumping through my veins.
The men moved closer around her. Unlike the day before in Terry Cassidy's office, however, she made no move to resist.
What happens in a few days?
Zakharov only smiled and said,
You will be kept comfortable at all times.
You are kidnapping your own daughter?
I am kidnapping a CIA agent with malicious intent. If that person also happens to be my daughter, then yes, I am kidnapping my daughter. I was sent here to make the hard decisions. I pride myself on my utter mission focus at all times.
He put his hand on her shoulder. It was a gentle touch, but his eyes and his words conveyed a different attitude.
So, my darling, do not test me.
Zoya felt like a child being admonished. Meekly, she asked again,
What is this all about?
It's about your mother, your brother, and you. It's about the Five Eyes attacking me, personally. And now, my dear, it's about my personal retribution.
So this operation has no sanction, she said.
Zakharov pulled his shoulders back.
I have sanction, he shouted. That's all that matters. Moscow will benefit, but I take orders from no one.
Zoya couldn't believe it. He was insane.
You're off reservation. A rogue agent.
Zakharov gave his daughter a look of disappointment.
You've met Mr. Fox here. He studied under your mother in Moscow. Very much a Russian. He has infiltrated the fabric of life here in the United Kingdom. He is one of a dozen sleepers still active after all these years. Many working within Scotland Yard, the intelligence services, even at Whitehall.
Fox said,
Your mother was a remarkable woman. Of all my trainers, no one did more to give me the tools to remain alive and operational over here for all these years.
Zakharov said,
He will oversee your care, because I have much to do both back in London and at our destination. I will see you again very soon, Zoya. We will talk more then about what it is you want out of this life of yours.
Where is he taking me?
Not far, in the scheme of things. You'll see.
And with that, he turned and walked out of the room. Zoya wanted to call out to him, but she couldn't make a sound. She didn't know what she'd expected, but what she had just learned was almost too much to process. Whatever he was doing, whatever his plan, it was obviously more important to him than she was. Fox led Zoya and the men holding onto her arms out the door and back towards the waiting helicopter. As she was getting strapped in, she saw her father's big black helo lifting off from the perfect lawn 100 meters away, turning on its axis. And then, dipping its nose towards London, it disappeared over Vladimir Belyakov's mansion moments later. Chapter 43 The benefit to Court Gentry of having Sir Donald Fitzroy working for him as a technical asset, even if it was just for a few hours, was that Fitzroy could produce virtually any piece of gear he wanted simply by pulling it out of a drawer somewhere in his home. The man had collected more than a half century's worth of the tools of spycraft, and much of it was still modern enough to employ effectively. Fitz selected a pair of tiny listening devices, both with encrypted wireless connection and remote power switches, and while Court could tell they relied on 15-year-old technology, he could also see they'd been well kept and therefore remained good enough for his purposes. This was all the gear Fitzroy needed to go to his club in Westminster shortly before 3 p.m., enter the quiet room off the main hall, where Cassidy liked to do business, and position the bugs for maximum effect. He hid one on the top of a curio cabinet and out of view, and taped the other to the bottom of the table in the center of the small room, on the side where Fitzroy had seen Cassidy sitting when Fitzroy would glance in, passing by the open door from time to time. He left the equipment on the off setting, then headed into the men's lounge to order a brandy and read the paper in an overstuffed leather chair. Terry Cassidy showed up alone just 15 minutes later and came into the lounge holding his briefcase to say hello to some acquaintances. Fitzroy barely knew the younger man, so he looked at his paper, opened and closed the three remaining fingers on his right hand to combat the phantom pains he felt from the two missing ones, and waited patiently. Soon Cassidy had mingled sufficiently, so he slipped back out into the hall. Fitzroy followed him out with his eyes and saw the 40-something heading towards his usual room, pulling a small transistor radio-looking device from his case as he walked. Fitzroy recognized it as a store-bought bug detector and breathed a sigh of relief that the solicitor had not upgraded his tech since the last time Fitzroy noticed it. Cassidy would sweep the room slowly, the walls, furniture, the phone, but the detector wouldn't pick up the equipment that was currently turned off and not signaling or even emitting any electrical current. Sir Donald headed out the front door, walked across the street, and climbed into his Mercedes. Court Gentry was behind the wheel, dressed as Fitzroy's normal chauffeur, but in his lap he held a micro notebook computer, and in his ears he had Bluetooth earpieces ready to receive from the recording devices as soon as they were turned on. Fitzroy climbed into the back, diagonal from Court, and he said,
"They are both placed. He is probably just finishing up sweeping for bugs now."
Court said, "He entered the club alone. Is there anyone in the room with him?"
"Not at present."
Court said, "We'll wait a bit."
"Fine by me. I'm a pensioner, you know. I've no place to be."
Court reached into his pocket and pulled out several over-the-counter pain pills. He took them with a swig of sparkling water. Fitzroy saw this.
"How do you feel?"
"Like I look."
"Good Lord."
Court smiled.
"I feel like I lost a fight with a steamroller."
The older man in back said,
"Most blokes know better than to get into a fight with a steamroller."
Court sipped more water.
"This bloke believed his hype for a minute and thought he could take down a monster."
To this, Fitzroy laughed.
"You'll get him next time, lad, and your hype will continue to grow."
Court didn't want there to be a next time with the big ape, and he certainly didn't want his hype to grow. He closed his eyes and tried to ignore the pain he was in. David Mars was on his way to London, sitting in the back of his Hilo, when his phone vibrated in his pocket. He patched it through his headset, stopping any intercom transmissions so the pilots couldn't hear his conversation.
"David Mars."
The voice was soft, unsure.
"It's Barnacle."
Mars had been expecting this call. It had been the biggest item on his plate today, until he got the call this morning about his daughter showing up at Belyakov's house requesting to see him.
"I thought I might be hearing from you," he said.
"Did you do it?"
Mars smiled a little.
"And by it you mean..."
Now Barnacle all but yelled into the phone.
"You know exactly what I mean. Did you have Lucas Renfro killed?"
A slight pause.
"The agency was getting too close to our prized possession, you, and we couldn't let them swoop in and prevent you from leaving the country. This will lower the heat in the kettle until you arrive here."
He added,
"I told you I'd keep you safe."
Jesus Christ, Mr. Black. You can't just kill a deputy director of the CIA.
Apparently you can. It's already on the news, man. They say it was an obvious suicide.
Yeah, well, I hope your assassin was fucking perfect, because I heard Matt Hanley was first on the scene.
Matthew Hanley, you say?
Mars's supreme confidence remained unfazed by the news that the deputy director of operations was investigating the case personally.
He'll be pleased they got their leaks sorted, and he'll be on his way over to the UK, ready to put this all behind them. He'll believe the suicide story, and he'll not suspect you for a moment.
I don't want to go to Scotland now. Too risky. I want you to pick me up in London.
Mars paused for a moment.
I very much could use you inside at the Five Eyes conference. You might hear a thing or two that could earn you a lot of money from me.
At this point, sir, fuck your money. You told me you had a DACA waiting for me in Russia, and I have enough Bitcoin to cash in and live comfortably. Sure as shit beats living out my days at a supermax prison here in the States.
Mars breathed slowly into the phone for several seconds.
Fair enough, Barnacle. We'll come up with a plan to sneak you away as soon as you arrive in the UK.
A man sitting alone at a picnic table in a park in McLean, Virginia, heaved his chest and blew out a long sigh of relief right into the phone he had held to his ear. But his relaxation was exasperatingly short-lived, because CIA's assistant deputy director of support noticed a big black GMC Suburban pulling into a parking space on the far side of a baseball diamond. He thought the vehicle looked like the exact same one that had tailed him through the streets of D.C., and a fresh panic welled inside him. The door opened, and the big blonde-haired man in aviators, who'd sat across from him at Whole Foods, climbed out, stood there, and crossed his arms as he looked on. Marty Wheeler sucked in a terrified gasp.
That's great, Mr. Black, because the same goon who tailed me yesterday is standing next to his truck watching me from about 50 yards away. I don't know if I will even make it to England.
Mars's aristocratic British voice always remained cool.
You'll make it, lad. Means nothing. Renfro's been dead less than 8 hours. It takes time to stand down a counterintelligence operation. You'll be on your jet over here soon, right? You won't see the watchers on you for much longer.
I hope you're right.
You have a plane to catch, mate. We'll see you once you get to London. I'll have a taxi pick you up, one of ours, with a driver who knows what he's doing. He'll take you to the Peruvian embassy. I have an arrangement with them that they'll shelter people before I get them out of the country.
You do this sort of thing a lot, do you?
Only when required. Just relax. Do what you do, the same way you always do it, and everything will be fine. In 48 hours, you'll be at the Dhaka we bought for you in Ekaterinburg, and living an easy life.
Don't try to sell me bullshit, Black. It won't be an easy life.
It definitely won't be if you don't find a way to modulate your tone before the two of us finally meet face to face tomorrow.
Wheeler closed his eyes. He needed Mars now. Everything that had led up to today had resulted in this mysterious Englishman being his only lifeline.
I'm sorry, sir.
Don't trouble yourself. You'll be fine when you get here.
Wheeler hung up, eyed the big man in the aviators again, then stood to head back to his car. It was farther up the lot from the man surveilling him, so he didn't have to walk by him, but he still gave the man an extra wide berth. Soon he was in his Nissan and heading towards Ronald Reagan to board a commercial flight to London. Court Gentry and Donald Fitzroy sat patiently in the Mercedes, eyeing the Red Lion Club across the street. They were giving Cassidy enough time to scan the room for bugs and to settle in before flipping on the transmitters. Soon, the Englishman broke the silence.
Let's say Cassidy says something that implicates him in whatever's going on. What are you going to do?
Whether or not he says anything, when he leaves here I'm going to grab him by his collar, put a gun in his ribs, take him to a basement somewhere. Then I will start cutting pieces off him till he tells me what I need to know.
He turned back to Fitzroy.
I'll wait for him to leave your club. I won't burn the place to the ground.
I do greatly appreciate your discretion.
Court nodded to his friend and former employer.
Thanks for all this.
For nothing, lad. Any time. But allow an old man to offer some advice.
What's that?
You know, you can't do this sort of thing forever, don't you?
Court touched his still painful jaw with his fingertips, then looked down to the laptop with the listening software on it.
Depends on your definition of forever. I wake up every morning wondering if today is the day that forever runs out for me. But this is all I know, and I'm pretty good at it, so...
Fitzroy leaned over between the seats.
Let some other poor sod get good at it. You need to get out of it. You'll die on this bloody job, and you are smart enough to realize that.
It occurred to Court that Sir Donald had never talked like this back when he was making a commission on Court's operations, but he still felt the old man had genuine affection for him, so he didn't judge.
Yeah, no question I'll die on this job, but there's always some new asshole that needs dealing with, and I have a hard time turning away from that.
Fitzroy nodded.
Well, if I can't convince you to stop, perhaps I can remind you to keep your head down.
Court said, that I can do. He put his fingers on the buttons of the micro notebook.
Okay, let's listen in on this asshole.
Court flipped the transmitter on, but as soon as he looked back up, he saw a pair of black Range Rovers pulling up in front of the Red Lion Club. Court's eyebrows furrowed as a three-man security team exited the chase vehicle, and a single young, fit man climbed out of the front passenger's seat of the first Rover and opened the back door. A man in his 60s exited the vehicle. He was heavy with a mostly bald head and an expensive-looking suit. He headed up the steps and through the front door of the Red Lion Club, with three of his body men staying close to him the entire time.
Court said, Is that bald-headed dude a member?
No, Fitzroy said. But I recognize him. That bald-headed dude, as you put it, is on the list you showed me.
The list of Russians? I thought you said your club didn't let Russian gangsters in.
Yes, well, this bloke isn't a gangster. That's Vladimir Belyakov, the oligarch. Owns a football club, department stores. Hell, he owns as much land as the Queen.
Court looked back over his shoulder in astonishment.
Really?
Fitzroy snickered.
An exaggeration, lad. The point is, he's got the money to walk in any door in this dirty city he wants to walk in. He's not a member of the Red Lion, but I've seen him there a time or two.
Court reached down and turned the volume up on the receiver app on the laptop. Almost immediately, he and Fitzroy, who had his own Bluetooth earpiece in, listened to the squeak of a heavy door straining on its hinges, then the sound of the door shutting.
The room's been swept,
a Russian-accented voice asked. The response came in British-accented English.
Just did it. Let me pour you some tea.
I don't want tea. I want to know what happened.
Dead bodies all over my office. That's what happened. The police are swarming the bloody place now.
What might they find as they look around, Terry?
My safe was broken into.
Your safe? What would someone possibly be looking for in your safe?
Court detected a tone from the Russian that indicated he was aware of more than what he was letting on. Cassidy hesitated.
After I got the call about the gunfight from building security, I managed to get in and take out all the incriminating evidence left behind before the cops arrived.
All the evidence left behind. Are you saying that there was something missing?
Yes,
Cassidy said, after a moment's delay.
The computer with the client data. It was well protected, but the bloody thing is gone. It's got your name in there, Vladdy.
Even through the audio, Court could tell that Belyakov already had this information. He seemed completely unfazed when he said,
That is extremely unfortunate for you, because I was a good client, whom you have now forever lost.
Cassidy said,
Wait, I just...
Belyakov kept talking.
Still, I am not worried about myself. What does the information prove that I have offshores? People would think me mad if I didn't, and I can move the money from my foreign banks into new accounts by the end of the day, certainly before anyone can access them and clean me out. So don't worry about me, Terry. I'm not your biggest problem. Your biggest problem, however, is the other names on the list. I know who some of your other clients are, and they are the types who express their displeasure harshly.
Cassidy did not respond to this. Court imagined the man squirming as he thought about the names from the Russian mob tied to account numbers, all information now in the hands of the CIA. Belyakov said,
"The Bratva will come for you, Terry. You must know this."
Apparently he did not, because he said,
"Don't be ridiculous. I am just a solicitor, a middleman. I was robbed. Not my bleeding fault. I just need to get the iPad back, and then that will put everything right."
Belyakov laughed loudly over the microphones hidden in the room.
"If you didn't keep that file as a security blanket, you wouldn't be in this fix, and you wouldn't have the Bratva after you."
"Look," Cassidy said, "you could reach out to our friend."
"For what purpose?"
"He has influence over the Bratva. He can calm them down. And if he can't, he has all the protection I need. You know, he could get a dozen guns around me in an hour. The real deal. He has connections in Moscow. Hell, he could probably get Spetsnaz over here to help me."
In the Mercedes outside, Court cocked his head. Behind him, Fitzroy spoke softly.
"The mastermind."
Court nodded.
"Cherny Volk.
The Black Wolf." Belyakov said,
"Thierry, it will surprise you to learn this, but the person who stole the client list from you last night was none other than our friend's daughter."
In the Mercedes, Court looked up out the window towards the Red Lion Club.
"What?"
he whispered in amazement. Chapter 44. Back inside the Tony Members Only Club, Terry Cassidy said,
"What? He has a daughter?"
"Da, and she's CIA."
The solicitor gasped. Belyakov added,
"I just found out about it myself. He just found out she's alive and working with the agency. I don't understand it all, but I know she is a danger to his work and to my livelihood."
"Bloody hell,"
Cassidy said.
"He met with her an hour ago, and now he's holding her prisoner. He recovered the iPad, but there is no way of knowing if the information has already gotten out to CIA. We have to assume it his."
"What are we going to do?"
"You, Terry, are going to do nothing but take a vacation. Somewhere far away. Get lost. It's your only chance to stay alive."
Belyakov's voice lowered.
"I am Russian. I know what the Bratvas are capable of. You do not want to be here when they decide they are angry with you. There are no half measures in their revenge."
"Yes. Yes, of course, Vladdy. You are right. I'll leave today."
"No. You'll leave now. Let's exit the club together. I have a security detail outside. You'll ride with us. We'll get you back to your flat. But then, you are on your own."
Court Gentry was a flurry of movement in the driver's seat of the limo. As Fitzroy watched from his seat behind, he saw his former contract assassin take off his chauffeur's cap, pull a Glock pistol from his hip, and then quickly grab a long black suppressor from a bag next to him and spin it on the threaded barrel.
"Whatever you're planning, lad, I think you need to..."
Court finished screwing on the barrel.
"You still know how to drive?"
"Of course I do."
"When I get out, you will get behind the wheel. I want you to floor it in 20 seconds. Just race across the street and pick me up right in front of those two Range Rovers. Keep your head down." "No, Court. We can get to Cassidy at his house, where he doesn't have a gang of Russian bodyguards standing around next to..."
"I'm not going after Cassidy. I'm going after Belyakov."
Court pulled a black mask out of his pack and put it on top of his head like a cap. He did not pull it down over his face, but he readied it to do so.
"Not with six men protecting him, you aren't,"
Fitzroy pleaded.
"Fuck that, Fitz. Did you hear him? Zoya's dad is the Black Wolf and he grabbed her. He's a deep cover asset, former head of GRU. He sounds like a scheming prick, dangerous to Zoya and dangerous to the U.S., and I bet that rich prick who's about to come through those doors can lead me to him."
Court did a press check to make sure his weapon had a round in the chamber, pulling back the slide and touching the casing itself, then dropped the magazine to ensure that it was fully loaded before snapping it back in and holding his gun in his lap.
"Lad," Fitzroy spoke slowly and softly from the back, "I haven't been in anything like this in 30 years. Not sure I'll do you much good."
"If you can turn the steering wheel and punch the gas, you'll do fine." Court then reached for the door latch, taking a slow, settling breath as he did so. Terry Cassidy and Vladimir Belyakov walked out the front door of the club and descended the steps to the sidewalk. Belyakov motioned for his bodyguards to move on to the Range Rovers while he slowed with Cassidy, taking a moment to speak with the younger Englishman alone. Court observed it all from across the street, where he quietly opened the car door and climbed out, his weapon shielded behind his right leg. He stood on the sidewalk not 40 feet away, watching the two men behind the crowd of security. He started to cross the street, pulled the mask down over his face, and prepared to lift the pistol and shout out in Russian that any one of the four guards or two drivers who drew on him would catch a bullet between their eyes if they moved. But a white cargo van raced by in front of him, causing him to leap back to avoid getting run down. The van slammed on its brakes, the tires squealed, and Court immediately heard the sound of what seemed to be at least 3 AK-47s firing fully automatic. Court yelled to Fitzroy, just now climbing out of the back of the black Mercedes to get behind the wheel.
"Stay low!"
Court began running across the street, shielded by the white van. In just a few seconds, he was at the driver's side window on the right, and he could see two men in the front of the vehicle. The front passenger fired through his window, directly into Terry Cassidy, who went down in a hail of bullets and smoke. But Belyakov's security men poured from the two vehicles, guns up and out, and they began returning fire. Court had concealment from the van, but little cover. Belyakov's men's pistols could tear through the vehicle's skin with ease and hit him while returning fire at the van. But Court did not fire on them. Belyakov was on the sidewalk, and if there was a chance the oligarch hadn't yet been shot, Court sure as hell wasn't going to shoot him and lose his one link to Zoya. Instead, Court knew he had to end this gun battle as fast as possible. He put the muzzle of the Glock against the driver's side window. The driver spun towards the movement, and Court shot him dead between the eyes. A second round went into the back of the neck of the front seat passenger, and then Court moved around the front of the van, his trigger finger pressing, and the silenced pistol snapping in his hand. He poured rounds through the window shield at the two men with AKs, seated in the back and firing up onto the sidewalk out the side door. He moved backwards in the street as he fired, desperately trying to back away from the ripe target the van made for Belyakov's bodyguards, and hoping against hope that Belyakov's men who were still alive would realize he was helping them engage these targets. He fired a total of 14 rounds in the middle of the street into the van before he stopped to check for any remaining threats. Seeing no movement through the spider-webbed and broken windshield, he pulled a fresh magazine from his waistband, dropped the partially depleted mag onto the street, and hammered the new one up and into place. The van smoked and hissed, but no more gunfire came from it. Court spun his reloaded weapon towards the sidewalk now. He couldn't see past the two shot-up Range Rovers, so he moved between them, pistol high, and through his ringing ears, he heard screaming, shouting, crying, all from terrified civilians nearby. And he heard sirens approaching from multiple directions. He came out from between the SUVs and saw Belyakov clearly alive and Cassidy clearly dead. The Russian was on his hands and knees, looking around in a state of shock, and the British solicitor was sprawled on his back in a growing pool of blood, eyes wide and vacant. Around the sidewalk side of the Rovers, he saw four of the six of Belyakov's detail on the ground, and the other two slumped dead behind the wheels of the Rovers. Two men on the sidewalk looked like they'd died shielding their protectee, their bodies close together in front of where he now knelt. And the other two were sprawled out on the sidewalk behind the two Rovers, one alive, one dead. The one guard still living looked to Court like he might have some fight left in him. He lay on his side and bled heavily from his stomach, but he still struggled to move closer to the Russian oligarch. A rifle fell onto the street outside the van on Court's left, and then a wounded attacker stumbled out. He fell to the street as well, then pushed himself up to his hands and knees and reached for the AK. Just as he wrapped his hand on the sling to drag it closer to him, Court spun to him, calmly lined his pistol up on the front of the man's head, and fired a single round into his brain pan. The man dropped flat on top of the weapon. Court shot him once more, to be sure. The sounds of sirens grew louder. Court rushed over to Belyakov, who by now had rolled into a sitting position. He didn't seem to be hurt, but the surviving bodyguard next to him had been gut-shot, and Court could see intestines between his fingers as the wounded man tried to hold them in. Though horrifically injured, the man saw Court and started to lift his pistol up, but Court just reached down and pulled it away from him. He knelt over the wounded man. "I'm taking your protectee, but I'm not with these killers, and you have bigger problems than losing your job right now." The man spoke with a weak voice.
"Medkit, back of both rovers."
Court pulled Belyakov to his feet, yanked him out into the street, and threw him into the Mercedes as soon as Fitzroy pulled up. He then opened the rear of the lead Range Rover, pulled out a red backpack with a white cross on it, and threw it to the man on the sidewalk. Court doubted he'd be able to do much for himself, but at least he'd die with some purpose. Court climbed in after Belyakov, and Fitzroy began driving off. After just a few seconds, Court leaned up between the front seats.
"Fitz, we aren't going to a church. Step on it."
The older man accelerated, but not much. Court just rolled his eyes and returned his attention to the dazed Russian next to him. Sir Donald Fitzroy followed Court's directions back to his safe house in West Kensington, dropped him off, and then, following his former contract employee's wishes, drove off through the rainy afternoon and tried to forget everything that had just happened. He'd get rid of the Mercedes, he'd stay inside his flat for the next week or more, and he'd have his daughter-in-law and grandkids come and keep him company. This had definitely been a first for the old man. He'd been in hundreds of operations in his lifetime, but being the wheelman during a shootout on the street in Mayfair was a new experience, and one he had no desire to repeat in any fashion. Court manhandled Belyakov down the stairs to the basement flat, held him there while he unlocked the door, then pushed him into the house and down onto a kitchen chair. He ripped the cord of a floor fan out of the wall, cut it off where it went into the fan body, and used this to lash the Russian's hands behind him and through the slats of the chair back. The 65-year-old was still in a state of disbelief, looking around him in confusion even now, 25 minutes after the shooting stopped. Court drew a large kitchen knife out of a drawer, then held it as he dragged the chair with a terrified and compliant Russian billionaire in it across the kitchen area into the small living room. He positioned him in front of the sofa, and Court sat down in front of the man, wincing with pain as he did so. He had suffered no injuries in the shootout, but the effects of yesterday's one-sided fistfight would remain with him for quite some time. Holding the knife down between his own knees, he leaned close to the heavy Russian.
"Okay, boss, I need you to pay attention here, so I can lay down the ground rules. You with me?"
Yes. Who are you?"
"First rule, I ask the questions."
A slight nod from Belyakov, and then he looked towards the front door.
Court shook his head. "Nobody's coming for you, except to retrieve your body when the smell gives it away."
Belyakov's eyes snapped back to Court.
"I can make you a very rich..."
Court cut him off. "Asshole. You know how many dead bodies have said that to me 10 seconds before they became dead bodies?"
The Russian had no response to this other than a look of dread.
"Now," Court continued, "as things stand, you are dead. I have no intention of letting you walk out of here with your life."
"What have I done to you?"
"I'm a psychopathic killer, Vlad. I don't need a reason to stick this knife in your neck. I am, however, open to negotiation. I only need a little information from you, and if you give it to me, I won't kill you. If you delay in giving it to me, then I'll hurt you."
Court leaned forward.
"You do believe I am capable of hurting you, do you not?"
Belyakov nodded slightly.
"I saw what you did back there. I know you are capable of anything."
"Good. Now, first question. Where is Zoya?"
"Who?"
Belyakov asked, giving a reasonable performance.
"And we started off so well,"
Court said. He lifted the knife, slid it up the inner thigh of the horrified man, and placed it with the tip on Belyakov's genitals.
Here's where the hurting will start.
Yet, please.
Zakharov's daughter. You told Cassidy he took her. Where did he take her?
Belyakov's eyes remained locked on the steel blade between his legs.
I don't know what he's doing. Where he's gone. He doesn't tell me things.
You might be filthy rich, but that lie just cost you one of your most prized jewels.
Court made as to thrust the blade into Belyakov, but the Russian screamed,
Yet! No, no! Oh, okay.
The knife was retracted a few inches. You have 5 seconds.
Look, sir, whoever you are working for, I can buy you off that job, and...
Court pushed the knife forward and into the crotch of Belyakov's trousers, and then he made a quick cut through the fabric. Belyakov's manhood, covered by black silk boxers, fell out of the hole. He'd not been cut, and neither had his boxers, but now he was even more exposed to the knife. Court looked down, then back up at Belyakov.
I really don't want to see your junk, dude. I don't want to cut it off, either. That's nasty for a bunch of reasons. Just tell me where Zakharov is, and you spare us both a really lousy afternoon.
I don't know where he is. I swear it.
Court sighed, then shrugged.
Here we go.
The knife tip pressed against Belyakov's balls.
But I know who he's with.
Again, the knife was retracted a few inches.
Who? Artyom Primakov.
Means nothing to me.
Goes by the name Roger Fox. He looks and talks like a proper Englishman, but he's from the Bratva. He's a vor. He and Fyo are working together, outside London right now. I do know that much.
That's not going to help me.
2 hours ago, Fox called me and told me one of his helicopters is grounded for repairs. He has to use one of mine based in London at Battersea Heliport. I am sure they are in the air by now, but I can give you the tail number. Maybe you can find it.
Court just looked at him with eyes filled with malevolence. This wasn't enough. Belyakov recognized this, then said,
I can contact someone, find out where the helicopter is now. It's run by a corporation in Wales. They'll be able to track it.
Court nodded slowly.
That would be nice, Vlad. I appreciate it. You just bought your nutsack another 10 seconds. Now, who were those gunmen back there at the club? Why did they try to kill you?
They were Solnetsevskaya assassins. They weren't there to kill me. I haven't crossed the Bratva. They were there to kill Cassidy for losing a list with their names and account information on it. But those gunmen are just poorly trained animals. They would have killed everything on that street to get to Cassidy.
Court said,
Zakharov, is he the mastermind?
What? What does that mean?
He's working with London organized crime to promote Kremlin interests.
Belyakov's face gave nothing away.
It's absurd. Where did you hear Cherny Volk? Is Fyodor Zakharov the Black Wolf?
Belyakov gazed down again at the knife, a look of utter defeat on his face. Eventually, he said,
Da.
Court responded with,
I need to know what he looks like now.
Belyakov shook his head.
He doesn't allow himself to be photographed. You'll find him in person before you find a picture of him.
This wasn't what Court wanted to hear, but still he untied Belyakov's hands and handed him a burner phone. He ordered the Russian to find the location of the loaned-out helicopter. It took him less than 10 minutes to do so. Immediately, Court retied the bindings.
It flew to Edinburgh. Just arrived.
Why would Zakharov be going to Scotland?
I have no idea. He owns businesses, perhaps he...
Under what name?
Name?
He doesn't walk around doing business in London calling himself General Fyodor Zakharov. What's his alias?
Belyakov looked even more defeated now.
I don't know.
He didn't even try to sell this lie to the man with the knife.
Bullshit. Sorry, Ivan. After all that info, you're still gonna lose a nut.
The knife went down between the Russian's legs. Court pulled the tip of the blade up and slit the boxers wide open. He pressed in farther, then flicked the tip of the blade up an inch. Belyakov screamed. Court didn't think he'd done much more than break the skin with the knife, but he also didn't want to look at the man's exposed balls to check. Belyakov was totally his now. The man shouted,
Mars! David Mars!
David Mars,
Court repeated. His name was on the list from Cassidy's vault. He asked,
And what is he planning, Vlad?
I truly do not know.
Court thought that was all he was going to get out of the man, but slowly the terrified prisoner looked up, locking eyes with him.
But whatever it is, it does not have Moscow sanction. How do you know that? He doesn't get orders from Moscow. He runs anti-Western operations here, keeps things deniable for the boys at the Kremlin, but...
Court cocked his head.
But what? But he changed when he thought his daughter had been killed. I know he is planning some sort of retributive strike against the West. His wife, his son, his daughter, all were killed by England or the U.S. When his daughter showed up, I thought he might just call off his plan. But he's bent. The wheels were already in motion. Plus, he sees his daughter defecting to the Americans to be much worse than death.
Retributive strike. Court said it to himself. In Scotland. Court pulled out his phone.
Your lucky day, Belyakov. You get to keep your life and both your huevos.
He left the room as he dialed Brewer's number. Chapter 45. The Bombardier Global 7000 was the largest executive jet in the world. This particular model, owned by the CIA, had seating for 20, and at present there were 15 on the aircraft in addition to a crew of 4. Most of the passengers were clustered in captain's chairs and sofas near the front, but Director Fred Capshaw sat alone in one of 2 small offices in the back of the plane, looking out the window at the Atlantic Ocean 40,000 feet below him. Matt Hanley appeared in front of the director, Capshaw motioned to the chair opposite him, and the deputy director of operations took a seat in the tiny room. Hanley said,
"You wanted to talk?"
Capshaw was from Kentucky and had an accent to match.
"I do."
Now the older man looked out the window a moment more, seemingly collecting his thoughts.
"It was just months ago when your predecessor sat in front of me and I gave him a version of the talk I'm about to give you. As you know, within a couple of weeks, you had replaced him."
"Am I being replaced, sir?"
Capshaw moved around in his chair uncomfortably for a moment, as if trying to find a position that didn't hurt his back. Finally, he said,
"Matthew, you came into the DDO position like a bull in a china shop. I let things go because your predecessor ran operations like it was his own private army. The department needed an enema, and you sure as shit gave it one."
Hanley didn't know if he was supposed to say thank you, so he just nodded.
"But here we are, 4 or 5 months after you took the DDO desk, and I'm beginning to harbor concerns about your decision-making abilities and your unaccountability."
"I am completely accountable, Mr. Director. Accountable to you."
"I told you on day one, son, that I was going to give you unusual latitude to conduct your work as you see fit. But a horse can take loose reins to mean his rider isn't paying attention."
"I always assume you are paying attention, and you know everything that you need and want to know."
"I don't know what's happening in your special programs."
"I could fill you in, sir," Hanley said,
and this line was received as he'd expected.
"Don't get cute with me, Matthew. You know I need to be insulated from sub rosa activities. You and I can have a verbal agreement that I've loosened up your sanction, and you can take that to mean, within reason, that I'm okay with you doing what you think is right. But when the light of day finds your dirty work, then it becomes a problem that must be rectified."
"I understand."
Director Capshaw said,
"Matt, I've given you enough rope to hang yourself with, and it appears that's exactly what you're doing right now.
Sub rosa ops are always difficult, but the potential rewards outweigh the risks. We've got a lot of moving parts and, yes, some problems right now, but I will take care of everything."
Capshaw didn't seem to be listening. He said,
"I won't be taking the fall when you go down. I'll cut you away from me to survive."
Hanley nodded at this. He actually appreciated a man who told him hard truths, as opposed to lying to his face. He said,
"It won't come to that. I'm rectifying the situation. I have my best people working on it, and I expect to have it all wrapped up before the end of the conference."
Capshaw said,
"I am hearing talk that you don't believe Renfro was the traitor."
Hanley seemed uneasy, and the director noticed this.
"Speak up."
"I don't think he was the traitor, no. I believe his death was staged. He was murdered so that we'd stop looking."
Capshaw heaved a big sigh.
Well, shit.
That complicates things even more.
It does, but it's narrowed down to two men. Both are either in or on their way to the UK. I'll find out who is responsible while they're here. I guarantee it.
The director of Central Intelligence said,
I'll give you till we return to the States in 4 days, but no longer. I want all dangles tied off in a ball before we are feet dry in the U.S., or I shutter all your Sub-Rosa activities until you get your house in order. Is that clear, Matt?
Absolutely clear. Thank you, sir.
Hanley stood up and left the rear of the aircraft. Zach Hightower didn't like flying commercial, and he sure as hell didn't like flying economy. But he'd booked his ticket to London at the airport just 90 minutes prior to takeoff, so he had to take what he could get. He did manage to get a seat far behind Marty Wheeler, who lounged up in first class. Zach wasn't bumpering him at the moment. He didn't want Wheeler to know he was heading to Europe just yet. Brewer had reached out to him before takeoff, telling him his job when he got to the UK was to tail Wheeler until he went to the US Embassy, directly from the airport, and then begin his close surveillance of operations executive Alf Carlson, already there at the embassy. Zach was on his computer looking over a London map when a secure message system popped up on the screen. It was Brewer checking in with him. Zach knew she and Hanley were also in the air to London now, a couple hours ahead of him. Brewer typed, Wheeler is behaving himself?
Of course he is, Zach wrote, because he's not our guy. Palumbo is clean, too.
Well, if it's not them, then it's Carlson, and you'll see him soon enough. Zach typed back,
I bet it was Renfro. That dude was obviously hiding something big.
After a time, a response came.
Yes, I concur. I'm going to talk with DDO about this again.
Brewer logged out of the chat, and Zach closed his own computer. He had his orders, and he would obey them. For now, it was time to watch a movie and get some sleep. Suzanne Brewer moved over to an empty seat next to Matt Hanley, who had just returned from a short meeting with the director in the rear of the aircraft. He was handed a bourbon by a flight attendant, and he sipped it as he noticed Brewer's arrival.
What's up?
I've been messaging Romantic. He feels certain Wheeler is clean. We've also established that Palumbo was not the mole.
Hanley said, I knew it wasn't Marty. So, that leaves Carlson.
Well, sir, that is one theory. The other theory is that we had it right all along. It was Renfro.
Hanley shook his head.
Sir, I have to ask. Why have you suddenly become Renfro's champion? You hated the guy. Everybody knows that. Romantic said he was hiding something. He was scared of his own shadow, always looking over his shoulder. What the hell else would Renfro have to hide, other than being a traitor?
Hanley took the glass next to him, then drank down the remains of his bourbon. He leaned forward just a little, although no one was in earshot considering the low volume of their voices. He spoke even softer now.
Marital infidelity.
Brewer cocked her head.
What are you talking about?
Hanley's big chest filled with air and he let loose a long sigh.
Lucas Renfro was sleeping with a woman at an apartment he owns in Woodley Park. Her name is Katrina Lawrence. It has been going on for some time, and his wife is very much in the dark about it. Renfro was worried he'd been found out, and this is why he was freaked out by Hightower's surveillance of him.
Brewer did not hide her shock.
That's an incredible compromise for a deputy director. How could he pass his periodic lifestyle polygraph if he was having an affair? He would be fired in an instant if that ever came to light.
Narcissists don't poly well. He probably thought nothing of it.
She cocked her head.
How the hell do you know about this affair?
I've known it for a very long time, actually. Katrina Lawrence is my ex-wife.
Brewer was gobsmacked.
You knew Renfro was screwing your wife, and you didn't do anything about it?
Ex-wife, he repeated, then shrugged. We've been divorced for years.
He shrugged again.
Renfro broke up the marriage.
She just stared at him, astonished he'd never confronted the man about sleeping with his wife. Hanley understood the reason for her expression.
It's the spook in me, Suzanne. I wanted to hold this bit of intelligence in my pocket till I needed to leverage it against him. I could have called his wife and told her whenever I felt like it. I could have told the director, but I wanted to save my big reveal for the moment it could do me the most good, or Renfro the most damage. Even getting him fired was setting my sights too low. I wanted to destroy him, personally, professionally, psychologically.
Brewer sat back in her cabin chair a little. Well, just because he was committing adultery does not mean he wasn't also a traitor.
Hanley said, Very true, Suzanne. But there were enough clues at his crime scene to tell me he had help with his death. I did not do it, much as I would have liked. Removing me as the prime suspect, my conclusion is someone killed him because they needed to implicate him in the treason, perhaps to throw us off the scent.
So, then who did it? Romantic insists Palumbo and Wheeler are clean.
He hasn't evaluated Carlson yet.
Brewer smiled. Romantic's on a flight right now. We'll be in London in a couple hours after we land.
Hanley nodded. This is exactly why you are in the position I have you in.
He reached for his iPad and began thumbing through some work. Brewer started to stand, but Hanley took her by the arm gently, and she leaned down to him.
Suzanne, Romantic and Violator are weapons-free as of right now. If Anthem is recovered alive, she is now officially a Poison Apple asset, and she is weapons-free as well. I want them to find the traitor, with Romantic tracking the potentials while Violator works the problem from the other side, tracking Belyakov and his Russian mob connection.
Yes, sir, she said, wanting to put up some sort of a fight, but knowing resistance was futile at this point.
Hanley added, MI5 and MI6 are both operating under the assumption they have a mole, same as we are. Therefore, Poison Apple will not be supported by local assets in the United Kingdom. The two of them, the three of them, if Anthem shows up, are going to have to find a way to do this themselves.
Hanley looked towards the rear. Walt Jenner and his seven other operators sat close to one another in the low light. Many slept, a few watched movies on tablet computers.
Scratch that. Hanley said. I've got a ground branch team available to assist them in an in-extremis situation. Let Violator know that.
Brewer closed her eyes, unconcerned that her boss would see how much she fundamentally disagreed with what she was being ordered to oversee. CIA assassins and paramilitaries running willy-nilly without local approval across the United Kingdom, targeting Russian mafia and sleeper agents, a CIA mole, and God knew whatever else was involved. This entire shit show was about to blow up even more. Suzanne Brewer could just feel it, and she hated her life. Then her phone rang, and everything suddenly got so much worse.
Brewer,
it was Violator.
Zakharov is alive. He is in play, and I think he's going to attack the Five Eyes conference.
What?
I don't know how, but he's in Scotland, and he's planning some sort of retributive strike against the UK and America for what they did to his family.
What the hell did we do to his family? Court explained everything that he knew, then finished by saying,
You have to get them to call off that conference.
You don't just call off the Five Eyes Symposium. I will let Hanley know about this new threat, see what he wants to do.
We don't even know what the threat is, Suzanne. How do you protect against that?
Guns, gates, and guys, she replied flatly. Trust me, that castle in the Highlands will be the safest place to be on Earth for the next few days. The knock at the door to Court's basement apartment came at 7 in the evening, a half hour after Court had been promised by Brewer that someone would arrive to watch over Belyakov. He looked through the peephole, then unlocked the door and opened it. The same young bearded redhead from whom he'd taken the Volvo and the equipment the day before stood there, and he gave Court a surprised look.
You, he said. Me. What's up, Red?
It's Jason, actually. What happened to your face?
Court didn't answer. Instead, he said, November Delta Zulu 14 Golf Whiskey.
He crossed his fingers, then lifted them up by his face.
Your turn, kiddo. I'm rooting for you.
Jason laughed at this despite himself. I've been practicing. Oscar Kilo 78 India X-ray.
You rock,
Court said with a tired and pained smile. To this, Jason just said, I heard you shot up my Volvo. Court stepped aside so Jason could enter and said,
Dude, I was crouched down behind it when the bullets started hitting it.
The thing this afternoon in Mayfair is all over the news. Was that you as well?
I don't kill and tell.
Jason continued up a hall towards the main room, but Court took him by the arm and stopped him in the darkened hallway.
The subject is Vladimir Belyakov. You know him?
Know of him, sure. Damn. Really?
He's going to need some new pants before you take him out of here. We don't need him charged with indecent exposure.
Damn,
Jason said again. I want a gun in your hand at all times. The location is secure, and he's tied to a chair and not going anywhere. But remain vigilant. He knows things that people will do anything to keep quiet.
I don't have a gun.
Court sighed. CIA case officers didn't normally carry firearms.
Take mine. I've got a spare.
He unstrapped the Glock 43 from his ankle and handed it to the young man. Jason took the weapon and said,
We can't work with the Brits for some reason, so it will take 2 hours for a cleanup team and an extraction team to show up. I'll watch him carefully till then. When the cavalry arrives, we'll get him out of here and the safe house sanitized.
Good man.
Court hefted his backpack off the floor and slung it over his shoulder, groaning in pain with the movement.
Thanks, Red. I've got to run.
The young CIA case officer followed Court to the door and locked it behind him when he left, then drew the Glock from its holster. He headed back up the hall to begin his shift babysitting one of the richest men in London. Zack landed at London Heathrow at 9 a.m, shuffled off the aircraft with the rest of the passengers back in steerage, and made his way towards passport control. Since Wheeler was traveling under a diplomatic passport, he made it through much faster than Hightower, who had documents supporting his civilian cover. When he finally got through, Zack began jogging through the airport, scanning in all directions, knowing he couldn't lose Wheeler, not because there was still any chance that he was the mole, but because his orders from Brewer were not to lose him, and Zack was a man who prided himself on always following his orders to the best of his abilities. Soon, however, Zack realized he needn't have worried about misplacing the dapper 51-year-old assistant deputy director. While Zack just had a satchel over his shoulder with another set of clothes and a few odds and ends, Wheeler stood waiting for his checked bag with virtually everyone else from the rest of the flight. Zack rushed on through the airport, went outside, and then, after a few more minutes of jogging, found his way to the vehicle Brewer had waiting in the short-term lot for him. It was a boring four-door Kia, which didn't exactly thrill the former SEAL Team 6 man, but he climbed behind the wheel and dropped the visor to catch the key fob that fell down. Minutes later, he was back in the arrivals area in front of the international terminal. He pulled in as if he were picking someone up. Wheeler appeared ahead of him, climbing into a black cab, and Zack followed him through the scrum of vehicles trying to get off airport property. He thought about his job to come. For some weird reason, Hanley wouldn't admit that Renfro was the traitor, even though that seemed obvious to Hightower. So Zack would be stuck following this innocent boor to the embassy, and then following some other innocent boor around London before heading up to Scotland for the conference where, no doubt, Zack would be tasked with following both Wheeler and Carlson around some more. Zack followed Wheeler's taxi, hanging back, not bumpering. The thrill of all this was long gone now that the man he was certain was responsible for the treason was dead in the morgue. This was a boring gig, nowhere as exciting as what he'd hoped for. He figured that wherever Court Gentry was these days, that was where the real action would be going down, and this pissed him off. Zack followed the taxi to the east, approaching Greater London. He stayed far back, not that he was worried about the cabbie noticing he had a tail, but simply because it was more work to do a close-in follow, and he already knew the assistant deputy director was heading to the embassy, so he had no real fear of losing him outright. He hung a dozen car lengths off his objective vehicle, trying not to lose him in the sea of other black cabs out there, but didn't stress too much about it. In morning traffic, it was over an hour's transit from Heathrow into the city, but when Zack began driving along the Thames on Great West Road, he knew he was getting closer. The U.S. Embassy was on the south side of the river, and he fully expected to be following the taxi across the Battersea Bridge, but the cab bypassed the turn and continued along the northern bank of the Thames. This seemed odd to Zack, but still, he didn't stress. The cabbie would know the way better than he. And then the taxi made a left on Oakley Street, turning to the north and away from the embassy. And now Zack was thoroughly confused. He started to call Brewer, just to let her know that he'd be delayed getting to the embassy because the suit he was tailing was diverting. probably heading to Harrods for pink socks or some shit. But just before he tapped his phone, the taxi made a quick right turn on King's Road. This was followed by another right on Chelsea Manor, and now Zack was pulling up tighter to the taxi, worrying he would lose Wheeler with all the oddball maneuvers his cabbie was making. Another right turn on Cheney Walk, and then a jog to the left to put him on the Chelsea embankment, and for a moment, Zack wondered if the cabbie was heading to Battersea Bridge to cross the Thames, because he was now traveling back to the west. But this theory didn't stand 10 seconds of time. Wheeler's cab turned right again, back on Oakley. They'd just driven in a large square. Zack knew a few things in life, for sure, and one of them was that London cabbies do not get lost. And that meant only one thing to him. Is Wheeler running an SDR? And then another thought occurred to him. It would have to be one hell of a weird conversation in that vehicle ahead for Wheeler to ask the cabbie to make an unnecessary series of turns and doublebacks. The only thing that made sense was that the cabbie was the one doing the SDR, and Wheeler was just along for the ride. As the taxi made another right, Zack reached for his phone. Chapter 46. David Mars took his phone from his pocket and answered it while stepping out of Dr. Wan's laboratory. He stood on a third-floor stone balcony, looking down at the University of Edinburgh. It was a rainy day in Edinburgh, but for the moment the precipitation was light enough for Mars to stand here and remain dry.
Hello?
Black, it's Barnacle.
Excellent, mate. You're in London?
Yes, I am, but...
But what?
The driver you had picked me up is doing an SDR, and we've detected a definite tail.
This was distressing to Mars, but not overly so.
That's unfortunate.
No shit, it's unfortunate. If they get the idea I'm not going to the embassy, they might make the reasonable assumption that I'm running, which will lead them to the assumption that I'm the one they're looking for.
Don't worry, Barnacle. We won't let that happen. You're almost free and clear. That cabbie works for the Sonnets of Skya Bratva, and he'd get his bloody throat slit if he doesn't get you to the destination in one piece.
That's it? That's the only assurance you have I won't get picked up in the next 10 minutes? Look, Black, don't forget how much you don't want me to fall into the hands of your enemy.
Go carefully, Barnacle. I don't want you to be harmed or held, but I also do not take well to threats.
Just please get me out of here. I don't want to go directly to the Peruvian embassy. I don't have any manpower to stop a snatch team if they come for me.
You soon will. I'll send a team to meet you. We'll get you out of that cab and better protected. Just tell your driver to keep driving and give me a few minutes to arrange something.
Rush them, please.
David Mars hung up, then called out to Fox, who was in the hallway outside the third-floor lab, talking on his phone. He hung up and rushed in to Mars to see what he needed.
Sir? Barnacle is compromised down in London. Need some of your boys to bring him in, as quick as you can assemble them.
On it, he said, as he pulled his phone out again. I'll have them contact the driver and meet somewhere near the Peruvian embassy, but not too close by.
Zack Hightower was having a difficult time convincing Suzanne Brewer that he now believed Wheeler was up to something. She challenged him on this over the phone, insisted the cabbie must have been looking for some address, and told Zack to calm down the more animated he got. But Hightower could not be swayed.
They're just driving around in circles now. They know they have a tail, and they aren't trying to shake me, so they're obviously trying to stall. That makes me worry.
Worry about what?
About the possibility they are planning something.
Now the cab drove north up West Carriage Drive, through the center of Hyde Park and Kensington Gardens, and Zack tried to think ahead several steps in his adversary's plan. He didn't know where he was going, but driving the one road that led through the middle of the park seemed like a bad idea from the perspective of someone who was being tailed. But then he realized what his adversary's game was. Right in front of him, the taxi rounded a turn and stopped in the road, right next to a maroon passenger van, which itself slammed on its brakes. Marty Wheeler leapt out of the taxi and into the open side door of the van, which immediately launched forward, whipping past Zack at speed. He could see that the van was full of at least 4 men, in addition to the American CIA exec. Zack pulled a hard U-turn, bumping up onto the grass alongside Carriage Walk Lane to do so. Zack spoke to Brewer through his earpiece mic.
Subject has changed Vix and now is heading south, surrounded by muscle.
Brewer just muttered,
"Unreal.
I need you to tell me what you want me to do here. He's making a definite overt run for it now, and he's got four Slavic-looking knuckleheads surrounding him."
Brewer said, "Look, Romantic, you might just have to handle this yourself."
"Lady, I just got off an international flight. I don't even have a damn gun," Zack said.
"Yes, you do," Brewer interrupted. "There should be a weapon with extra magazines in the glove box."
Zack checked quickly, pulled out a Smith & Wesson M&P 40, a 40-caliber pistol in a retention holster, then checked to make certain it was loaded with one hand while he drove with the other. He said,
"Got it. Orders?"
"If Wheeler switched vehicles and has security, then there is a reasonable chance he is guilty of being the mole. Do you concur with that assessment?"
"Sorry, lady. Went to state college. It was more about baseball and co-eds and less about learning what concurring with assessments means.
But if you're asking me if this motherfucker who surrounded himself with Russian shitheads and is desperately trying to lose anyone tailing him is guilty as hell, well then my answer is abso-fucking-lutely I concur."
Zack read off the street names he passed, and when the van turned to the left, he told Brewer they were heading into Knightsbridge. Brewer took a moment to respond.
"I'm driving myself to the embassy now, but I'm looking at the map on my phone, trying to figure out where they are going. That part of Knightsbridge has a lot of embassies."
After a moment, she said,
"Shit, the Peruvian embassy. Their government is tight with the Russians and decidedly anti-American at the moment. They'll carry Moscow's water for them."
"How far from where I am?"
He gave her the intersection he passed.
5 minutes with traffic. You don't have much time to stop this."
"Stop this? No chance you can get any backup on the way to me, is there?"
"I really need you to handle this alone, Romantic."
Zack then asked,
"Wait, you're in London. You're in a car, and you're near the embassy. That's less than 10 minutes from me. Why don't you get your butt over here?"
"Wait a second, Romantic. I'm not trained for..."
"I need a car to help me tail, box, and extract Wheeler. My Vic is blown to the oppo."
She hesitated. After a moment, she said,
"Okay, I'm not a field operative, but I'm in Whitehall, less than 5 minutes away from you, in fact. I can head that way, but only to help with the tail. I don't have a weapon in my car."
"Come on, then. I'm going to break off this tail and go up a side street, haul ass to the Peruvian embassy. If I can get in front of them, I can be waiting for them when they get there."
"Good.
Rules of engagement?" Zack asked.
Brewer said,
"Listen up, Romantic. I don't want them taking him someplace we can't reach him. I'm giving you authority to detain Assistant Deputy Director Marty Wheeler at this time."
"I'm not going to ask you who gave you the authority to give me the authority to do that, but I am going to ask you what I'm supposed to do when the Russians protecting him express their displeasure in my actions."
Brewer replied with,
"Only escalate if absolutely necessary, but meet force with equal force."
And then she added,
"You have lethal authorization."
Zack waited no time before giving his response.
"Hot diggity damn, Susie. I love it when you talk sexy. Call me when you're a couple minutes out."
And then he touched his earpiece, ending the call. In the passenger van, Marty Wheeler looked down at his shaking hands. He'd so hoped to just slip away, to be a